radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. A comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, oh, why did you ever go? Oh, won't you please come back and entertain us? I long to turn the dial again to hear the past smile again. Radio, I miss you so.
Once again, it's time for Yesteryear. A look back at your favorite dramas, westerns, comedies, and musical variety shows from the golden age of radio. Here's your host for Yesteryear, Craig Roberts.
Well, thank you, Dave, and welcome again to Yesteryear, the best from the golden age of radio. On today's program, it's The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, and Inner Sanctum Mysteries, Death Wears a Lonely Smile. Inner Sanctum's creaking door is perhaps the best-remembered sound effect in the history of radio, beckoning listeners each week to another night of horror for more than a decade. Inner Sanctum Mysteries aired from January 1941 through October 1952 and spawned a series of Hollywood films starring Lon Chaney Jr. Raymond Edward Johnson was Inner Sanctum's first host. He was followed by House Jamison and Paul McGrath, who made the macabre role his own for the duration of the radio run and in the 1954 syndicated television series. Today, it's Death Wears a Lonely Smile by Ed Adamson and Bob Sloan. A young woman meets a strange, hulking man in a graveyard who claims to be waiting for a dead woman. Produced by Hyman Brown, starring Paul McGrath, Bob Sloan, and Mercedes McCambridge. Inner Sanctum Mysteries, Death Wears a Lonely Smile, on this edition of Yesteryear.
Major Bowes, I miss the shadow knows. Fred Allen's alley folks, the laughter of Duffy's Tavern. Helen Trent, then we went to Can You Top This? Suspense in the Whistler sent those shivers up our spines. Uncle Don, I wish that he was on. Jack Armstrong, Merton Marr, Jameis, and Andy.
Good evening, friends. This is your host to welcome you through the creaking door into the inner sanctum. Come in. I want you to see the changes we've made around here. Very, very smart. Now, this new morbid motif was designed by those southern decorators, Topsy and Eva. This three-part section of sofa was made especially for the wife of Harry the Hatchet Man. You see, Harry left his wife in pieces, so naturally, we let the Chippendales fall where they may. Now, here's our new dropped living room, just freshly dug. It's for rent, a real bargain. All you have to do is slab on a down payment.
Tonight's Inner Sanctum Mystery, Death Wears a Lonely Smile, was written by Ed Adamson and Bob Sloan, and stars Mr. Sloan in the role of Walter, with Mercedes McCambridge as Carol.
Well, now let's get to tonight's torturous tale. Find your places and make yourselves comfortable before we begin. As Harry the Hatchet Man says, we're not seating anyone before the first act's curtain falls. It's dusk, and a cold wind whips through the burial ground, stirring the leafless branches into wordless whispers of dead, forgotten voices. Amid the gravestones, the big man with a bloodied gash in his forehead stands, hatless, his massive, ape-like arms hanging limply at his side, his eyes set in a lost, vacant stare. The big man remains there, transfixed, as the young woman in black comes out of the shadows behind him.
Can I help you?
Where did you come from?
Well, I was over there putting flowers on my father's grave, and I saw you. You were standing here, and you seemed lost, so I...
Lola.
What?
I've been waiting for you, Lola.
Oh, I'm not...
I knew you'd come if I waited, Lola. I knew you would.
But my name isn't Lola.
I waited so long. I waited every day.
I told you I'm not Lola. You've mistaken me. My name is Carol.
Carol?
That's right. Carol Finley.
But Lola said she'd come. She promised me. I need her.
Who is Lola?
Lola's my friend. She never made fun of me because I'm so big. Lola never laughed like all the others, like all those other ones who are so mean. What's your name?
I told you, it's Carol. What's yours?
Walter.
Walter, you better let me take you home.
Home?
Yes. Where do you live?
Why, I don't know.
There's something the matter with you. Yes, you're hurt, that cut on your forehead.
Cut?
Yes. Look, I'll take you to my place. My mother has a rooming house, and you can stay there until you feel better.
No, I can't go. I must wait for Lola. I promised I'd wait
Walter.
For her.
Walter?
Yeah?
Was her name Lola Douglas?
Yeah, Lola Douglas.
There's no use in your waiting.
Oh, you mustn't talk like that. She'll be here. She will.
She's already here. That gravestone there, look at it. Lola Douglas died March 6, 1948. There you are, Walter. Now, that bandage will do for a while.
You're nice to me, Carol. You're like Lola. You're not afraid of me, are you?
Of course not. Why should I be afraid?
Because I'm so big. I remember when I was in school, a boy made fun of me. I grabbed his arm and I told him to stop. He just laughed at me. I didn't mean to hurt him, but I broke his arm. I just squeezed a little and it broke. Then they were all afraid of me.
They shouldn't have laughed at you.
I like you, but I can't stay here.
Oh, it's perfectly all right. I spoke to my mother, and she said that you can have my room for a few days, and I'll move downstairs.
Oh, I have to find Lola. I promised
Walter,
her...
Walter, try to understand. Lola is dead.
Oh, no.
She was buried over a year ago.
Oh, that isn't true. I saw Lola last week. I spoke to her.
All right, Walter. All right. And tomorrow you can start looking for her again. But now you must get some rest. You just lie down here and I'll...
Carol, why are you looking at me like that?
This was on the table among the things you took out of your pocket.
What is it?
A newspaper clipping.
I didn't have a clipping in my pocket.
It's dated March 7, 1948. Woman found brutally crushed to death. Victim identified as Lola Douglas.
Carol, I just stopped by for a minute. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought Carol Finley was here.
Carol gave me her... Lola.
Lola?
I knew you weren't dead.
Oh, my name isn't Lola.
I knew they were lying all the time, Lola.
No, I'm glad as heart. I live down the hall.
They were trying to keep me from you. Come in, Lola.
Let go of my hand.
Come with me, Lola.
Oh, please, let go. Oh, my hand, you're hurting me.
Oh, I wouldn't hurt you, Lola. You know I wouldn't.
Let go.
Oh, you mustn't talk so loud, Lola. They'll hear you. No. They'll think I'm hurting you.
Oh, please let me out of here.
Don't try to get away from me, Lola. I might hurt you. I don't want to hurt you, Lola, but you might make me.
Stop.
You see, I'm hurting you. You're making me, and I don't want to. What do you want?
Well, I was downstairs and I heard someone scream.
Who are you?
Carol's mother, Mrs. Finley. The scream came from this room, I'm sure of it.
No, Mrs. Finley, nobody...
There she is, on the floor in there.
Huh?
Get out of my way. Gladys, What have you done to her?
Well, she wasn't here before. Lola was here, but now she's gone.
Oh. Gladys, are you all right?
Oh, Mrs. Finley.
Who is she?
Oh, keep him away from me. Keep him away.
Now, you're all right, my dear. I'm here.
He tried to kill me.
No, I wouldn't hurt anybody.
Here's your pocketbook, Gladys. He probably wanted your money.
I don't want money.
There's money in it. How much did you have, Gladys?
Well, I just cashed a check. $68. It was your rent.
20, 40, 60, 5, 8. 68. Well, it's all here. Well, come on now, dear, and I'll take you to your room.
All right.
And you, I want you to clear out of here.
No, I can't go.
You're getting out, you understand? You're getting out.
I can't go. Lola's coming back. I promised her I'd wait, and I'm staying here until she comes.
Carol.
What is it, Mom? What's the matter?
I can't find Gladys. Her bed wasn't slept in. Did you see her?
No.
Well, I went to her room and she wasn't there. I had a feeling when you brought him home the other night. I had a feeling I should have turned him away. He's killed Gladys.
Oh, Mom, stop it. Stop talking like that.
Well, he tried it yesterday.
No, he didn't. Mom, he's just mixed up. You've got to try to understand him. Oh, please take it easy. Gladys probably left for work early.
No, sir, she didn't leave this house alive. I was in her room. He's done something to her. He's hidden her body.
Mommy, I don't believe he'd do a thing like that.
Then what about Lola Douglas? She was murdered a year ago. You told me about that yourself.
All right, I did. But there's no proof that Walter killed her. Mom, I understand him. I'll go up and talk to him.
No, you won't. You're staying right here. I'll do the talking to him. I've got to get him out of this house before we're all murdered. You've got to get out of here.
Please, Mrs. Finley, don't make me go. Lola will come back.
Lola Douglas was murdered a year ago.
That's not true. Lola's alive. I saw her last week.
She was murdered by you.
No, I wouldn't hurt Lola.
You killed her the same way you killed Gladys.
Oh, you shouldn't say things like that, Mrs. Finley.
You took Gladys out of here last night and murdered her.
No, Mrs. Finley, I didn't leave. I was waiting for Lola.
You're a monster, a horrible, crazy monster.
You're saying mean things to me, Mrs. Finley.
Well, I want you out of my house. I want you out right now.
You're not like Carol. Carol's nice. Carol said I could stay here in her room.
Yes, but not if you don't pay.
Pay?
Oh, I know you have no money. You can't stay here another moment unless you pay. And I want a month's rent in advance. Now, what do you say to that?
All right, Mrs. Finley.
And the quicker you get
here's
out of here...
Here's your money.
But where did
you... Is this enough for a month in advance, Mrs. Finley? Is $68 enough?
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear.
$68, Carol. Here, look. He gave me $68.
I don't understand it, Mom. Yesterday, he didn't have a penny in his pocket.
But don't you see what this proves? It's just as I told you. He's murdered Gladys. That's exactly what she had in her pocketbook last night. $68.
Sergeant Pierce, 12th Precinct.
Sergeant, this is Mrs. Finley, 529 Elm Street. You'd better come over right away.
Finley, 529 Elm. What's the trouble, lady?
Well, one of my roomers, Gladys Hart, she's missing.
Missing? Well, we don't handle that, lady.
Oh, but listen,
I'll switch you over to missing person.
Wait, just a minute, please.
Yeah?
Well, this woman, she's not just missing. She's been murdered.
Now, look, lady, which is it? She missing or murdered?
So both. She hasn't been in her room all night. She had $68 in her pocketbook and...
Hello? Hello?
You!
Good afternoon, Mrs. Finley.
Hey, what's going on there? Hello?
I'm sorry I troubled you, officer. I made a mistake. Gladys Hart's alive. She just walked in.
Who's there?
It's Carol, Walter.
Oh, come in, Carol.
I disturb you?
I was listening to the music on the radio. It's nice music, isn't it, Carol?
Yes, Walter, very pleasant.
Lola likes music just like that, too.
Walter?
Yeah?
I came up to apologize for the way Mom acted to you.
Mrs. Finley said mean things to me.
Well, Mom didn't understand.
Mrs. Finley said I killed that girl. I didn't kill her.
Yes, we know that now. Gladys came in a little while ago. She stayed at a friend's house overnight. Walter, where did you get the money you gave Mom?
Well, it was in my pocket. I found the $68 in my pocket.
But it was more than $68.
More?
Yes, Mom was so excited when you gave it to her, she forgot to count it. But you gave her $85.
Oh, I only had $68.
You must have made a mistake. You had $85. You gave Mom $17 too much. So here, she told me to give you back the $17.
Oh, you keep it, Carol. You're nice to me.
No, Walter, it's yours. Please take it.
Carol.
Yes?
This money, would you let me take you to dinner?
Well, you see, I do.
Oh, you wouldn't be ashamed to go with me because I'm so big. Because people would look at me and laugh.
Of course I wouldn't be ashamed.
Then you'll go?
Yes, Walter, I'd be very glad to go with you. I'll just run downstairs and get my things. You meet me out in front of the house in 10 minutes.
All right, Carol. I'll meet you. We'll have a nice time.
Yes, Walter, I'm sure we will.
Here is additional information on the murder this afternoon in Washington Park. An empty purse seems to be the clue to the brutal crime. The murdered woman had $85 in bills when she left the house last night. According to the police, the murder was undoubtedly committed by a large man with great power in his hands. Local and state authorities are conducting an extensive search.
Hey, stop playing the music. The music was so nice. And they stopped playing it.
Carol.
Mom, what's the matter?
Oh, I've been looking all over the house for you. You're all right?
Of course I'm all right.
Why are you putting on your coat?
I'm going out to dinner.
Out to dinner?
Yes, with Walter.
Him? Oh, thank heavens I got here in time.
Mom, what are you talking about?
He's a murderer.
Oh, you're not going to start that all over again, are you?
Well, it just came over the radio. A woman was killed last night in Washington Park.
That doesn't prove that Walter is a murderer.
It does. The radio said the woman had $85 in her pocketbook.
She had what?
$85. Well, that's what he gave me this afternoon, $85. That's what he killed that woman for.
Oh, Mom, I can't believe it.
Oh, that's how he suddenly had the money to pay the rent. And the radio said the woman was crushed to death by a man who was big and powerful.
Big and powerful?
It's him. Oh, and you would have been the next, Carol. Where is he now?
Well, I was supposed to meet him outside the house. I suppose he's out there waiting for me now.
Oh, that man's a lunatic, a crazy killing lunatic.
Mom, what are we going to do?
Well, you stay here in this room now and don't leave it.
What about you?
Well, I'm going downstairs to call the police. I'll be back in a few minutes. And remember, no matter what happens, don't leave this room.
May I help you?
Operator, the police. Quick, get me the police.
One moment, please.
Hello, Mrs.
Oh!
You're calling the police.
No,
you're going to tell on me.
No, you're wrong. I was going to...
Mom, what took you so long? I was...
Hello, Carol.
Hello, Walter.
I was waiting for you, Carol.
Well, I'm not ready yet.
You've got your hat and coat on.
Well, can't we wait just a little longer?
You're afraid. You're afraid to go to dinner with me.
No.
Otherwise, you'd go with me right now.
Well, all right, Walter, all right. I'll do just as you like. We'll go right now.
Carol. Why did you change?
Me change? I don't know what you mean.
I don't think you like me anymore.
Oh, but I do like you, Walter.
You want to get away from me, I can tell. You don't want to be with me.
I came out with you. I'm going to dinner with you.
But you don't want to. I can tell by the way you act. You keep pulling away from me.
Wait.
What is it?
Do you really want me to like you, Wally?
Yeah, very much.
Then I tell you what. This florist shop here, you go in there. You buy me some flowers.
Some flowers?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, all right. Well, what kind?
Oh, any kind. And I'll wait here while you do it.
No, you come with me. You pick them up.
Oh, but I want you to surprise me.
Oh, I don't want you to be alone. You might run away from me.
No, I wouldn't do a thing like that.
Well, if you want some flowers, you got to come in the shop with me.
All right, Walter. I'll go with you.
Good evening. What can I do for you?
What kind of flowers do you want, Carol?
Roses. Oh, yes, roses.
Roses are very nice.
A dozen?
Yes.
Well, I'll have them for you.
Oh, miss.
Yes?
Miss, I have to make a phone call. I wonder if I could...
Well, there's a pay booth over there behind the fern.
Oh, thank you. I'll just be a minute, Walter.
But, Carol,
you wait here for the flowers. I'll be right back.
May I help you?
Operator, give me the police.
One moment, please. Sergeant Pierce, 12th Precinct.
Well, listen to me carefully. I don't have much time. My name is Carol Finley, and the man who murdered that woman in Washington Park last night is with me.
Where are you?
In Kramer's florist shop on 6th Street, but we're leaving here in a minute. He's taking me to dinner at the Black Grotto down the block.
Black Grotto, I got you.
Please, hurry.
Don't worry, we'll get there in no time.
Oh, you have the flowers, Walter. Oh, they're very pretty.
Who did you call, Carol?
Why, I called Mom.
You talked to Mrs. Finley?
Yes, I just wanted to let her know where I'd be so that she wouldn't worry.
You talked to her?
Yes, I just told her that I did. Come on, Walter, I'm hungry.
All right, Carol. Wait, Carol, I'll call a taxi.
We're just going to the Black Grotto. We don't need a taxi. It's just down the street there.
I changed my mind, Carol. We're not going to the Black Grotto. I'm taking you to a nicer place. Much nicer.
Walter, why did you take me out here?
Oh, there's something in this cemetery I want to show you.
Walter, please, let's go back to Tom.
We won't be long. It's right here. This is what I wanted to show you.
It's an empty grave.
Yes, Carol. And we have the flowers to put on it.
But no one's in there. It's empty.
You'll be there, Carol.
Walter?
It's for you.
Oh, you don't want to hurt me, Walter. I'm your friend, remember?
No, you're bad. You're like all the rest of them. I thought you were nice, but you're not.
Don't you remember? I tried to help you.
You didn't call Mrs. Finley from the flower shop?
Yes, I did, Walter. I spoke to Mom.
That's not the truth. You couldn't talk to her. Mrs. Finley is dead.
She's what?
I killed her. She was going to tell the police about me. I put my hands around her neck and I squeezed and... she was dead.
I
put her in the cellar. Now I've got to kill you.
No, Walter, wait. If you do anything to me, there won't be anybody left to help you find Lola.
Lola?
Yes.
Lola?
Lee, yes, Walter, I can help you find Lola. I think I know where she's hiding.
Lola's dead.
No.
She laughed. She laughed at me. She said I was crazy, a big crazy fool. That's what she said. I thought she was my friend, but she wasn't. She was mean. She laughed at me. She was mean like all the rest. They all laughed at me.
I wouldn't laugh at you, Walter. I wouldn't.
I hate it when people laugh at me. I want to hurt them just like I want to hurt you because you're laughing at me now.
I'm not laughing. I'm not.
You are.
No, please, don't. Let's go,
stop
please.
Stop laughing. Stop laughing.
Please, Walter, don't.
If you stopped laughing, I wouldn't have to hurt you. But you won't stop. You keep on. Lola. Lola, make them stop. Lola, please make them stop. They're hurting me.
You all right, miss?
Yes, officer. I'm all right.
That was a close call you had. You didn't turn up at the Black Grotto. I checked with the florist. She saw him take you into a cab outside her shop. Lucky thing I got out here in time.
Yes.
He sure was a big guy, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. A big guy who didn't want people to laugh at him.
Well, that closes the lid on tonight's little coffin of curious characters. And Walter certainly proved a point. The bigger they are, the harder they fall into a grave. Say, Carol certainly had a narrow escape, didn't she? The poor girl almost died, laughing. You know, that's the trouble with most people. No sense of humor. Some of them just can't take a choke. All right, so my gags leave you morbid. You didn't want to sleep tonight anyway. Oh, did you? Good night. Pleasant dream.
From April of 1949, there's The Inner Sanctum Mystery with Death Wears a Lonely Smile. I'm Craig Roberts. You're in tune with Yesteryear, the best of the golden age of radio. When we return, it's The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, as Yesteryear continues.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear. Here's Craig Roberts.
Thanks, Dave. Welcome back again to Yesteryear. As our program continues, next it's The Black Museum from May of 1950, starring Orson Welles. Orson Welles revolutionized the Broadway stage and American radio drama, and his 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast created a national panic. In 1950, Welles was recruited by British producer Harry Alan Towers to reprise his movie role of Harry Lime in the Third Man radio series and star in a series inspired by Scotland Yard's legendary Gallery of Death. The Black Museum dramatized historical cases, focusing on some ordinary object that had figured in a celebrated murder case. The series was originally broadcast over Radio Luxembourg, a pirate station competing with the BBC's legal monopoly, broadcasting to England from Luxembourg. The Black Museum was rerun over the Mutual Network in 1952. Today, it's Raincoat. Partially burned raincoat is evidence in the brutal murder of an aged wife. The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, from May of 1950, on Yesteryear.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here, in a grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, there's a warehouse of homicide. A very strange room where everyday objects, a woman's shoe, a tiny white box, a quilted robe, all are touched by murder. You take this raincoat. It's a familiar object, waterproof cloth, rayon lining, collar. You can turn up against stormy weather. Here in London, it's called a Macintosh. But you wouldn't wear this raincoat.
Odd, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman?
And partially burned, as if someone had tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant, this raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position in that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death. The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
here we are in the Black Museum, Scotland Yard's museum. It's a museum of murder. Here are the objects of homicide, the weapons, the clues, which one time and another betrayed killers. They've been collected over 100 years. And now here they are, shelf upon shelf, in this dim, echoing room. Here lies death, on these shelves, in these glass cases. Just for instance, in this case, simple mallets. Just the sort of thing a suburbanite might use in his garage or his shop working at wood carving on a quiet weekend. As a matter of fact, a suburbanite did use this mallet on a quiet weekend, but not for wood carving. Ah, the raincoat. There we are. Stained, charred, too, around the edges. There's nothing you'd like to handle for very long, but there's a story attached to it. A story that begins in the kind of place you immediately associate with absolute silence. No, not a graveyard. A chess club. It is silent, isn't it? And into this silence of concentration, there intruded...
London City Chess Club.
Is Mr. Agard there?
Sorry, sir, I haven't seen him yet. This is the steward of the club. May I take a message? We're expecting him.
I see. My name is Champer. My address is 46 Edison Mews East. He knows. We've had some contact by way of Agard's insurance business.
Yes, sir. And the message?
I want to see him about a policy. Tell him it's rather urgent. I want him at my house tomorrow evening at 7:30 sharp.
Very well, sir. I'll tell him as soon as he gets in. Mr. Agard, sorry to disturb you, sir.
Just a moment, steward. There. Now, your move. Now, steward, a most important telephone message for you, sir. Came in about half an hour ago before you came in. Otherwise, I would never have disturbed you. From a Mr. Champer, sir.
Champer. Strange name. Oh, yes. Yes, perhaps I do know him. May I have the message, steward?
That was all. That was all until the next evening. A little bit after 7 o'clock on a streetcar, this quiet little insurance salesman, John Agard, said to the conductor of the streetcar...
I beg your pardon. Does this car take me to Edison Mews East? I've never been out there before, you see. I'm not...
Yes, you're all right, mister. Take you about 20 minutes from here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll call it out for you if you like.
Oh, yes. Thank you again. Thank you very much. Oh, I beg your pardon. May I trouble you for the right time, please?
It's 7:35.
I am right for Edison Mews East, aren't I?
Back one block to the car line.
Oh, thank you. I beg your pardon, Constable.
Yes, sir?
I am looking for a Mr. Champer. In Edison Mews East, I have an appointment. It's insurance. Do you happen to know the gentleman, officer?
Oh, I'm afraid not, sir.
Oh, dear, and my date was for 7:30. Is it much past that now?
7:45, sir. Steeple chimes just struck the 3:15.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'm sorry to have troubled you, officer.
He seemed a worried little man, John Agard. Upset over his difficulty in finding Mr. Champer, and he was still worried, apparently, about an hour later, when his next-door neighbors, Harry and Ethel Benson, saw him coming across the scrap of lawn which separated their houses.
Is Agard coming over? Funny.
Why is it funny, Harry? They come over very often.
That's just it. Martha isn't with him. Funny.
Such a devoted couple. Martha had a bad cold today. Perhaps John needs something.
Well, no, it's not enough. There he is. Hello, Agard. Spotted you coming across the lawn.
Yes. Good evening. You know, I am sorry to bother you.
No bother at all. Do you need something for Martha's cold?
Oh, you know about that. No, and yes. I suppose the cold made her forget to unbolt the doors when she went to bed.
You mean you can't get into your own house, old man?
That's it. Front and back. I can't seem to open either of them. I don't quite know what to do about
it. It's not like Martha to forget a thing like that. Does she always bolt the door behind you when she's alone?
Oh, at night, yes. There's only the two of us. I do so rarely go out without her, but tonight it was business. If you'd come across with me, I'd appreciate it.
The three of them crossed the lawn to the Agard house. Three ordinary people. An insurance agent, a bank clerk, bank clerk's wife. The wife said...
Let me try the front door, just for luck.
John Agard said.
It won't help her. I've tried several times.
The woman tried it.
That's a bit strange. I could have sworn.
It happens lots of times. The lock gets stuck. It's really open and you think it's locked and it just won't work.
Well, now you're here, won't you stop in for a moment?
What with Martha's cold and all that...
Oh, she'll like to see you. Come in, please.
Well, just for a minute.
Hey, Martha? Martha, dear? The Bensons are with me. Martha!
Oh, my...
Good Lord. Martha. She was dead. Completely, horribly dead. One look. No doctor could help. The woman's head was battered in. She lay before the fireplace, her arms and legs twisted awkwardly like some carelessly dropped wooden figure, and there was blood on the hearth, on the walls too, on the chair, on the rugs. And tucked around the body, as you tuck a blanket around a child, was a raincoat.
Let me go over this once more, Mr. Agard.
Of course, Inspector. If you think it'll help.
Details very often help. You say you left here just before 7, took a trolley to Edison Mews, but you couldn't find the address or the man who'd called you, even asked a constable on the beat. Then you returned home to what you found.
That is correct, sir.
And your wife was alive when you left home.
Oh, of course. That was about 7:15.
The boy who delivers milk says he saw her in the kitchen through the window about that time. The newsboy says he tossed the evening paper at the front door about 6:30, but saw no one. Can you corroborate any of those points?
Oh, I took the paper with me at 7:15. Martha was alive when I left. Who could have done this, Inspector? Who?
We'll find out. We usually do. May I see the cuffs of your trousers, Mr. Agar?
The cuffs of my... Oh, yes. But whatever for?
Thank you. No? No stains of any kind?
But do you really think for one minute that I could
We think nothing. Not yet. The raincoat, Mr. Agar, is it yours?
And are there two worn spots at the buttonhole?
There are.
It's none.
When did you see it last?
It was hanging on its usual hook in the hall.
I see. Thank you, Mr. Agard. That's about all. For now.
That's about all for now. But not nearly all. The experts were at work. Somewhere, somehow, the tiny thread which would lead to the heart of the tangle would be found. In a quiet office in Scotland Yard, Inspector Mason discussed the experts' reports with Sergeant Crandall.
It couldn't have been robbery. Agard reports nothing missing.
Agard reports a lot of things, including a mysterious telephone call that took him on a wild goose chase.
During which he seems to take good care to leave a clear trail of his own movements. She was seen alive between 6:30 and 6:45. Agard was in the tobacco shop at 7:35. The girl who works there remembers him.
He probably took good care she would.
Beyond a doubt he did that. But he couldn't have battered her to death after 6:45, cleaned up, destroyed whatever he was wearing, and still be in that shop at 7:35.
Or made that trolley car a few minutes after 7.
Exactly.
Which leaves us, Inspector?
With the raincoat.
It's odd, isn't it, Inspector? The way it was tucked around that poor woman.
And partially burned, as if someone tried to destroy the evidence.
Well, it is evidence, sir. But against whom?
I'm not sure yet. But this raincoat, Sergeant... This raincoat will hang someone. You can depend on it.
That was all they had. The raincoat. Inspector Mason thought about it.
It was tucked around her, just as if someone who loved her were taking care of her.
There was a thread. It seemed the only thread. Where did it lead? Where could it lead? Where could any of it lead?
John Agard, you're under arrest. And you'll be later charged with the murder of your wife, Martha. It is my duty to caution you that anything you may say...
Today, that raincoat can be seen in a very special position in that very curious room in Scotland Yard, which is known as the Black Museum.
In just a moment, we will continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
You're listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio. Swing Street Radio, where the big bands swing. The sounds of the golden age of radio continue with Yesteryear.
And now we continue with The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles.
Well, they charged John Agard with the murder of his wife, Martha. The evidence seems slight, pretty flimsy, but still, there were strange lapses, contradictions of character, quiet little insurance salesman responds to a call from a possible client, and suddenly he's talkative, almost garrulous. He establishes himself at definite places at definite times with total strangers, all of whom can be checked quite easily by the police. The possible client is non-existent. And then, of course, there was the raincoat. From the very beginning, the prosecutor for the Crown made it clear that a great deal of his case rested on that raincoat.
And if the prisoner did commit this murder for apparently no reason, he deserves the full punishment. Much will be made of the quiet life he led with his wife. Much will be made of the fact that no telltale trace of blood was found on him or his clothing. But I say to you, and we hope to prove this to your satisfaction, that this woman could have been beaten to death by someone wearing only the raincoat, which we will place in evidence. Now, who, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, could have approached Martha Agard naked save for that raincoat, except her husband, the prisoner, John Agard? Moreover, as you will see, the police officer...
There was more of the same, much more. Counsel for the Crown was out to make an impression, no doubt about that. But then, so was counsel for the defense.
My colleague has already admitted that no trace of blood was found upon my client, although from the condition of the body and the room, it would seem impossible that the killer could have escaped the touch of it. Then again, there was no time. John Agard could never have committed this crime, performed the necessary ablutions, and been where he was definitely seen between 6:45, when his poor wife was last seen alive by a third party, and 7:05, the moment when my client spoke to the trolley conductor. But far, far more important is the relationship between my client and his poor wife, a relationship of love, of understanding, of the perfect companionship of declining years. For that reason alone, I submit my client could never have committed the crime with which he stands charged today.
So it began. The legal lines of battle were drawn. 12 honest men sat in the jury box and gave their whole attention to the parade of witnesses, to the arguments, to the cross-examinations. Sergeant Crandall gave evidence on the amount of blood and the places where it was found. Defense counsel cross-examined.
It is apparent, Sergeant, that there was an attempt to burn the raincoat, which is now in evidence. Do you agree?
Yes, sir.
Such an operation would take some time, would it not?
Well, I assume so. I can't say for certain. I've never experimented with a raincoat.
Very well. You saw the scene of the crime before it was cleaned up, did you not?
I did.
From what you saw, would you say it was possible for the killer to escape splashes of blood?
Well, I doubt it.
He would get blood on his legs, his hands, his face, his hair.
I expect so.
Were any such traces found on my client?
Well, none that I know of.
There's been a suggestion made that the murderer took a bath before leaving the premises. Did you see any traces of a bath? A wet towel, indications in the bathtub?
No, sir. Nothing like that.
One more point, Sergeant.
These were the telling points. But the Crown made its own points as well.
Inspector Mason, what was your impression of the defendant when you first questioned him?
I was rather surprised at him. He showed less emotion than I did.
How was this indicated?
We sat in the room where the murder had occurred. Mr. Agard smoked and talked. He held his cat on his knees and stroked it quite calmly. At one point, he casually...
Such points do impress juries. A clever prosecutor. Quite clever. He called the steward of the chess club.
Was Mr. Agard in the club when the telephone call came from this mysterious Mr. Champa?
No, sir. I looked particularly. He was not there.
Did you recognize this Champa's voice?
I'd never heard it before.
I haven't heard it since.
Might it have been a disguised voice?
It might. It sounded muffled. Very heavy, sort of.
Thank you. Your witness.
Steward, in your observations of Mr. Agard, have you ever seen him behave as a poor loser?
No, sir, never.
Has he ever expressed violent opinions, to your knowledge?
Mr. Agard violent? He's the quietest man I've ever known.
Hmm. Did he ever mention his wife to you?
Many times, sir.
On what occasions?
Usually about 9 in the evening. He always worried about leaving her alone too late at night, sir. Oh, very considerate of her he is. Was, sir?
Thank you, that's all.
There it was, all they had. An elusive case. An impression, really, more than a case. Very difficult to prove, but just as difficult to defend. For instance, the evidence of Harry Benson, who was with John Agard when the body was discovered.
And in all the years you've been neighbors, what would you say impressed you most about my client's relationship with his wife?
His absolute devotion. Never a quarrel, never a raised voice. They liked the same things. They were perfect for each other.
Your witness.
Mr. Benson, after the discovery, who called the police?
Why, Agard did, come to think of it. My wife was very upset. She was sick over what she'd seen, as a matter of fact. Yes, he was the one who thought of the police. He used the telephone quite calmly.
Quite calmly. Thank you, Mr. Benson.
And naturally, the defense brought John Agard's immediate superior to the stand, the manager of the local branch of the insurance company Agard represented. This man's testimony was double-edged. On direct examination, he stated,
"We have always had complete faith in Mr. Agard's integrity and character. He carried a large policy on his own life in favor of his wife. She was not insured. To the best of our knowledge, which is rather complete, Mr. Agard has never been in financial trouble in his life."
On cross-examination, he explained,
"Yes, I live near Edison Mews East. Mr. Agard has been to my house many times. He knows the way very well. I cannot imagine why he asked for directions. I was at the cinema that evening. My neighbor recognized Mr. Agard when he came to the door of my house. Unfortunately, I was not at home."
When John Agard's turn came to take the witness stand, there was little left for him to say.
"I did not kill her. I had no reason to. I loved her."
Opposing counsel summed up. The judge made his charge to the jury.
"Again and again, you have heard the importance of the time element in this case. Could this man, or any man, have committed this crime, removed all traces of it from his person, dressed and been at a trolley car line 20 minutes from his house, in the time between the moment the milk boy saw the victim alive and the moment the conductor saw the defendant on the trolley car? More, there is no evidence to connect the defendant directly with the crime. The case is entirely circumstantial. No motive has been established. I can only..."
They listened. The 12 honest men in the jury box. They retired and they debated. What went on in that jury room is sealed in silence under the honored tradition of the law. Anyway, 40 minutes elapsed. Then the jury re-entered the courtroom. The clerk asked the usual question. "Are you agreed upon a verdict?"
"We are."
"Do you find the prisoner guilty or not guilty?"
"Guilty."
"Prisoner at the bar, have you anything to say why you should not die according to the law?"
"I am not guilty. I have nothing else to say."
"You are looking well, John."
"They treat me well. I had a shock yesterday. The governor of the prison came here. He said,
8 o'clock in the morning, Monday the 16th.
Don't worry, John. It will be put over.
The appeal?
It's being studied. The court won't rule for another month at least. They'll grant a stay of execution.
A month. Another month.
A month. An extra week after that. Time went on endlessly, it seemed, to John Agard, waiting in his cell in Walton Prison. And at long last, they gave him his own clothes and took him before three judges of the Court of the Criminal Appeal. Handcuffed, he stood there between the bailiff and his own counsel. The voice of the judge seemed very far away.
There is indeed a reasonable doubt in this case. We believe there is imminent difficulty and doubt. The case against the appellant was not proved with the certainty necessary to a verdict of guilty. This appeal will be allowed. The prisoner will go free.
Yes, he went free. But the raincoat, that famous raincoat, can still be found today in its place of very particular honor in that curious room known as the Black Museum. So, Inspector Mason was wrong, wasn't he? The raincoat didn't hang anybody after all. John Agard went free, and for the first time in the history of English law, a conviction for murder was set aside for reasonable doubt. Now, what happened to John Agard? He lived out his life. Just 2 years after his release, he died. Some say of loneliness in Liverpool, a broken, weary old man. I've seen his grave in Liverpool. And I've seen the raincoat, that famous, enigmatic raincoat, in its place of particular honor, in that strange room in Scotland Yard, known as the Black Museum. Now, till we meet again in the same place for another story of the same kind, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
The Black Museum, starring Orson Welles, produced by Harry Allen Towers.
From May of 1950, there's Orson Welles in the production of Raincoat on The Black Museum. Well, with that, once again, we're out of time, but that's all right. We'll be back here at this location again next week at this time and hope you'll make an effort to join us as well. In fact, why not invite a friend to tune in and enjoy the best from the golden age of radio on Yesteryear. Till next time, I'm Craig Roberts. So long.
Radio, remember radio. We'd sit and close our eyes and use our imagination. A comedy, mystery, a fireside chat. Together we sat, listening nightly to our favorite show. Radio, I miss you so. Dio, volio, dodio, do. Radio, I miss you so. Thank you.
Listening to listener-supported Swing Street Radio, KSSR DB San Francisco, where the big bands swing. Listening to your favorite big bands. Places like Glen Island Casino, the Coconut Grove. Relive the music and the memories. All your favorite bands from all the most exciting night spots. Coming up on Make Believe Ballroom, a part of Swing Street Radio with Craig Roberts.
Each week at this time, we present live recorded music from famous ballrooms and night spots from across the nation. In radio's early days, most of the music enjoyed by listeners came from live performances via remote. Places like the Aragon Ballroom in Chicago, the Palomar in Los Angeles, and the Palladium in New York were just a few of the locations where radio brought its microphones in order to bring fine listening and dancing music to the nation. On this edition of Swing Street Ballroom, we present a sample of just such a live broadcast. As the network announcers used to say, the nation's leading dance bands from the nation's leading dance spots. So, time now to move the furniture out of the way, roll back the carpet, and get ready to dance. It's the Swing Street Ballroom.
It's make-believe ballroom time.